The ARA acknowledges the traditional owners of the land where we have recorded this podcast, the Gadigal people of the Eora Nation, and we pay our respects to their elders past, present, and recognise Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islanders as Australia's first traders, who utilise a sophisticated network of trading paths that have facilitated the exchange of goods, knowledge, and culture for millennia.
Hi, I'm Paul Zara, CEO of the Australian Retailers Association, and welcome to Season 6 of the Retail Therapy Podcast, proudly brought to you by American Express. In today's retail landscape, it's vital to understand the nuance and intricacies of diversity, equality, and inclusion. It isn't just a buzzword, but a powerful force driving innovation and change across the sector. In each episode this season, we'll be focusing on the specific branch of the D&I tree, speaking to pioneers and leaders in their respective fields. Joining me for some Retail Therapy Season 6, focusing on diversity, equality and inclusion, is Mariam Bezadeh, CEO of Media Diversity Australia. Mariam is a trailblazing human rights advocate, lawyer, author and media commentator. Mariam founded the Islamophobia Register Australia and earned the accolade of Fairfax Daily Life's 2016 Woman of the Year for influencing positive change both in workplaces and society. Mariam is accustomed to being both an advocate against and a victim of xenophobia. And today we're going to hear her story. Mariam, welcome.
Thank you. It's great to be with you.
Now, Mariam, I believe you started out as a lawyer and then subsequently became a media columnist, and now you're one of Australia's most recognised anti-racism campaigners. Can you tell us a little bit about your journey, how your own experiences may have shaped that, the person that you are today?
Yeah, sure. Well, you've done a great job in kind of articulating the fact that I had one plan and then pivoted to another. And I suppose I've kind of explained this as not something that I sort of set out to do. You know, you don't go to your careers advisor and go, right, you know, how do I become an anti-racism campaigner? Like that's my career ambition. And so I think for me, a lot of the advocacy I've done has been what I describe as a side hustle. I've always had my day job, you know, that pays the bills, and the side hustle that doesn't, but it's just so important and the issues that I'm so passionate about. And so that's where that pivot has come from. It's come from issues that I've directly faced, be it racism, be it Islamophobia, and then adding the other layers of having an intersectional identity. And it's the issues that I've personally faced that members of my family and broader community and friends have faced, and therefore as the you know, being socially inclined and social justice being such a big influence in my life and the way that I was raised, I've always kind of gone, right, well, I'm not just going to walk past this problem, I'm going to actually roll my sleeves up and see what I can actually personally do about it, and whether I can use my skills, whether that as a graduate lawyer at the time, how can I help? What can I do? And that's hence why I'm starting an organisation, the Islamophobia Register Australia, but also actually becoming engaged in media, writing columns, you know, doing media interviews. All of that was very much in some ways being thrown into it, kind of not necessarily planning it, but then very much leveraging those opportunities and those platforms on which to advocate for social justice issues.
Now, you talk about the issues that you face. Can you describe that a little bit further for our listeners?
Yeah, so you know, I was fairly active on Twitter, as many people have been on various issues. I would, you know, provide my views and commentary, and I think I started becoming more active speaking up about issues impacting Australian Muslims. Inherently, that meant I was talking about racism, I was talking about Islamophobia, I was talking about the double standards in requesting sort of the collective blame that applies every time there's an act of terror globally, and that is Australian Muslims are called upon to apologise for something that they had nothing to do with, this sort of collective blame, and sort of unpacking that. And so I'd weigh into those conversations, and it was in the context of weighing in on some specific conversations that I started becoming the target of trolls, both locally and also internationally. And it snowballed from there. I was facing death threats. I had I had people finding my home address and sending bacon in the mail, just really mind-boggling stuff.
Wow.
And it's continued. I think it started around 2017, coinciding with when I started doing more Islamophobia work, and also coinciding with me having our first child, and feeling naturally a lot more vulnerable in that state. But I became the target of both, national and international trolling. It got quite comprehensive. In fact, if you go Wikipedia trolling, I'm literally an example. I'm a case study. So it reached that sort of and most recently a white nationalist who's actually written a book that I had to get Dimix to pull off their bookshelves, which is really interesting. It's about white nationalism, and he dedicates quite a bit to me. So that sort of targeting, unfortunately, has continued when you become an advocate against racism and you're speaking up on these issues. So that's where that came from.
Yeah. Awful, awful to hear, and I'm sorry, so sorry to hear that. Now, you started, co-founded the Islamophobia Register. Tell us a little bit more about that.
Yeah, so that's very much ties into why I face some of the trolling. I started this organisation as my side hustle, as I referenced earlier. I started it because personally, as a woman who used to wear a headscarf that I chose to do, and others in the community that were visibly Muslim, whatever, and that could be either what you look like or it could be your name. It could be your name, and it could be, the discrimination you may face because of your name sounding Middle Eastern, and there is research to back that up. So, it's a real thing. But I saw anecdotally that people were experiencing all sorts of issues, both physical incidents. I'm talking about, mothers pushing prams down the street and people spitting on them, that sort of physical manifestations of racism and Islamophobia, to online harassment and abuse. And so this was all happening and nobody was documenting it, but also nobody was going to the police about it. And when people did go forward to the police, it would be like, well, okay, what happened to you is assault. And that's it. The motivations behind the assault would rarely be discussed. And so if you're not tracking something, you're not measuring it, that saying of what gets measured gets actioned.
Yes.
And so there's no action if there's no understanding as to why these things are happening. And so I started the register, which was to document these incidents and to actually provide an evidence base that later we brought academic teams in, and we've been working with Charles Sturt Uni for the last 9 years to then scrutinise these incident reports and produce a report at the end that actually speaks to the trends.
Right.
Where is this happening? Why is it happening? Who is targeted the most?
Mm.
And unfortunately paints a picture of a lot of the perpetrators happen to be male, a lot of the victims happen to be female. And so it really speaks to this gendered racism that continues to perpetuate. And again, if you're looking to solve an issue, you need to understand it. And that's what we've tried to do with that organisation.
So Miriam, could you understand a little bit further? Is that information disclosed publicly? Can you tell us how many people, organisations are on this register?
Yes, so it's everything is de-identified. So we're not sort of naming people. It's all de-identified. But yes, over the course of 9 years, we've produced 3 reports. It's available on islamophobia.com.au. And these reports say, in the years between this period and this period, there were 374 incidents. Of these, X percent were physical incidents. Someone was pushed, someone was abused. X percent was online. And we're also starting to, the thing that I think will be interesting also to your listeners is that there is a category for shopping centres, incidents that take place in public, where there is security camera footage, where there is, security guards on hand. And so there are witnesses to these incidents. And I think that the thing that's really important to maybe reflect on is the bystander impact. And our evidence and the research shows that there very much is, there are bystanders who don't then become upstanders, as the term, as it goes. And then it's kind of about, so what we're trying to do is go, right, these things are happening. And the person that might be targeted could be your own family member. Mm. Do you in that situation interject if you feel safe to do so? Sometimes just saying, hey, mate, don't do that.
Yes.
You know, like that in its as simple as that can actually stop an incident from taking place and that ongoing trauma that that victim will face off the back of that. So, yeah, that's what the research shows. It actually shows where are what we call hotspots, where these incidents take place. And then we want to kind of turn that evidence base into campaigns, into right. how do, you know, if you see something, how can you interject? How can you, you know, just because it doesn't impact you yes. personally, doesn't mean you can't actually help stop it from happening somehow.
So those people listening, the website is islamophobia.com, is that correct?
Yeah, .com.au. Yeah, okay. that's where you can access, you can make an incident report irrespective and it can be someone who's a witness to something. They might see something.
Yes.
Anyone can report yeah. and they can put the details of what they, you know, and then that helps build, like I said, an evidence yes. base. And we've also tried and provide support to the victims and just raise awareness. I yeah. think in any issue, if you just raise awareness about what's happening, it can actually help stop those issues.
Now, Mariam, if you don't mind me asking, because we can see each other, we're doing this via online. You're not wearing a headdress. You've referred that you used to wear a headdress. Can I understand a little bit more? Why the decision not to wear a headdress?
Well, I'd say what I've just described to you yes. has played a role in that. I think, you know, it's a very
personal decision. So is that your response to deal with, to avoid Islamophobia?
Look, it's sad to kind of admit that, but that was part of the reason. It wasn't the entire reason. There was always so much more. I mean, for me, it was a very personal choice that happened to come about and coincide with COVID. And I mean, we all know what COVID, you know, like the trauma that so many of us experienced being locked in our homes and all of that, you know, third world problems, but, first world problem, sorry. So, but yes, that was right. one of the factors. I think having, when you are bombarded by Islamophobia and racism and you become the face of it, like I'm talking, you know, white supremacists literally yes. use my photos on their posters. You know, there's YouTube videos about me that, you know, there's just horrific, horrific material. Like I said, the latest is I'm in some white nationalist book. I started to face that risk. And I think right. there were specific incidents. I remember being in a shopping center with my young daughter in a pram and someone coming up to me and going, "Are you Mariam?" And me having this freak out moment going,
"Wow.
Oh my God, has my racism work put my child at risk because I'm visibly," and when you're wearing a headscarf, you are visible. And yes, I'd say that was one of the reasons, not the only reasons. And I've reflected on this with a friend of mine, Nyadol Nyon, who, you know, and she's also does a lot of anti-racism work. And I've reflected on the fact that she cannot switch off her skin color,
yes.
right? And she's got a, you know, dark skin color. And so she can't switch that off. But in my case, the removal of a headscarf meant that I blended in a little bit more.
Yeah.
It doesn't take away from the fact that I have a Middle Eastern sounding name. It doesn't yes. take away from the fact that I'm still very, you know, visibly perhaps Middle Eastern looking. But there's relative levels of prejudice that you face based on how much you quote unquote blend in.
Yeah, yeah.
And this is the thing. On the one hand, I want to raise my kids going, be who you are. Like, you know, you should be proud of who you are. And if you happen to look a particular way, if you happen to, you know, if this is your identity, be proud of it. Don't shy away from it. Don't shy away from your cultural heritage. And yet on the other, you know, on the flip side, not, you know, the more different you are, the harder life is.
Yes.
And that's not me having a big whinge, because I think I'm also very grateful for the opportunities that have presented itself by virtue of me being in Australia. And I came here as a refugee from Afghanistan. Mm. But I'm also very conscious that difference is something that isn't always celebrated. It might be formally celebrated, but sometimes difference unconsciously can actually lead to prejudice. It can yes. lead to discrimination. And so, yeah, I'm in two minds myself about how much do you, you know, be who you are, but then at the same time, being who you are means that perhaps you're not getting some opportunities, whether it's in your career or at school or at university, you know, whatever. The research doesn't lie, and the research paints a picture that the more there is a difference, be it in you know, research about resumes and how many people get a call back depending on what their names are versus experiences of microaggressions in the workplace and, you know, who makes it to the top echelons of Australian society.
Yes.
All those things play a role.
Now, as a result of your advocacy, has there been any positive outcomes? Because I know you've had many. This is because you've your journey's been quite a tough one, let's face it. But, you know, as a result of all the work that you've done, tell us a little bit more about the positive stuff that the outcomes you've achieved.
Yeah, thank you. I mean, there has been, and sometimes it's hard to reflect on that when the negativity kind of really wears you down. But I think I've done, like I said, I've called myself a sort of an accidental advocate. I feel like in many ways I was thrown into it, and it came from a place of frustration and going, I, to be honest, one of the reasons I also got involved and in doing media is because I didn't want the blokes to speak on my behalf, to be perfectly frank. And it happened to be a lot of, at the time, a lot of older men in the Australian Muslim community that would be first port of call for the media to speak about something. And I was like, he doesn't represent me. That's not what I think. And so I got involved in that. But I think the positivity that's come from that, there are a whole host of campaigns I've been involved in. The Islamophobia Register, having founded that organisation while I was in maternity leave, mind you, clearly I thought I had a lot of time in my hands. And that has, the outcome there is that those three reports that we've produced and the advocacy work that we've done means that we are able to provide the government and decision makers a basis on which to create policy change. We've had, I was called to give evidence at the Disability Royal Commission because the disability sector's looked at what we've done in the racism space with the register and gone, how can we do that with people that are experiencing abuse because of their disability? I've been approached by other organisations, including the John Barner Institute National Justice Project. They've taken what we've done with the register and gone, right, let's do this for the Indigenous community. So they've now started effectively a register of their own, which is reporting Indigenous abuse. And so, it's really crappy that people have to do that, and often these are volunteers, but it kind of also speaks to the fact that it's clearly an issue that people that are quote-unquote different to whatever we call the mainstream are being targeted, and they have to take it upon themselves to create these services to actually drive that policy change and raise awareness. So there's a whole host of things. There's been campaigns I've started, and my husband actually says to me every time I go on leave or something, he's like, please don't start another organisation or campaign. I'm like, okay. I can't guarantee that, but,
Well, congratulations on your achievement. I think a lot of people listening would be very grateful for the work you've done to date. Now, tell me, you're a CEO of Diversity, Media Diversity Australia. Tell us a little bit more about that role.
Yeah, look, it felt like a really great role that in some ways may have, like, you know, it's so relevant to what I've been doing throughout my career. Basically, a lot of the work that I was doing throughout my career and then moving into a diversity, equity and inclusion role, the work I'm doing at Media Diversity Australia is to kind of really champion diversity, equity and inclusion in the media sector. And, of course, the media is very broad and it's not a monolith, but within the media it's so much, you know, it's such a powerful sector because it's not just something that happens behind closed doors. It's everything that happens in terms of the curation of stories, who presents those stories, whose perspectives are captured in those news articles and news stories. Those things have such consequential outcomes. So I think in many ways doing the role at MDA as sort of inaugural CEO is a continuation of the work that I've done for, over two decades. And it is about going, well, how can we actually work with Australian media and the influence that they hold to ensure that, one, they better reflect and serve the Australian, better reflect their audiences but also those that are trying to crack into the industry and feel for whatever reason that they're not able to, how can we provide the scaffolding and the support to ensure that they're able to get in and they're able to thrive? So that's some of the work we're doing, and we partner with all all of the major media companies are members of ours. So News Corp Australia, 7, 9, 10, ABC, SBS, AAP, The Guardian, The Daily Oz. Wow. Like we, you know, and that list is growing. And we're increasingly also working with PR agencies and marketing and advertisers, because of course, everything you consume in terms of media, it's not just, you know, people rarely switch on the television these days, right? Media is everything you consume, whether it's the ads that you're seeing as you're heading into the airport, or the voices on the radio in the taxi on the way there, you know, or the images that we're seeing on the front of magazines, the your retailers, and the images that are in the front of shops as people are walking in, you know. Yeah. Any media that we consume, if people don't see themselves reflected, there is an ability to turn away.
Absolutely. Now, I imagine a big focus for you is holding media to account and driving transformation to ensure Australian media represents the diversity of our country. Does that achieving that change in media flow on to the broader diverse community that you're trying to promote?
Very much so. Yeah, absolutely. You've hit the nail on the head. And I think that's why the work that we do within media is so important. So I've done diversity, equity and inclusion across corporate Australia. I've worked in a bank. I've headed up the strategy around cultural diversity for a bank. That work is limited to almost, you know, of course there's external, you know, there's external factors and there is a flow-on impact, but the work you do within the media has huge consequences more broadly. It can speak to the, you know, someone like me, if I use myself as an example, as a young woman growing up, and this, I'll share a quick story that kind of, you know, makes the point I want to make. And I growing up, I gravitated towards journalism. I in particular adored Sandra Sully on 10, right? I grew up watching Sandra Sully on 10, and I really wanted to, I was interested in the news as a young person. And you know, I always go, you know, it's so easy to say Sandra Sully, right? It just rolls off the tongue.
Yes.
And she can go, Sandra Sully, Channel 10 News. You know, I can't really do that with my name. It just doesn't. So I wanted to be Sandra Sully, and I've actually told her this at an event, and she must have thought I was crazy. But, you know, I wanted to be a Sandra Sully, but also didn't see a Mariam or an equivalent on TV. And I kind of thought, well, no, I'll just go off and do what good migrants do, which is they become a lawyer, an engineer or a doctor, right? So that's the joke in our community. I just decided to become the lawyer, as you can tell, and now I'm a recovering lawyer. So I did that, but I didn't see myself reflected on TV. And so it just goes to show that doing, you know, the work we do in media is not just about, it's not constrained to the four walls of that media company.
Yes.
Ultimately, it reflects on, you know, the outcomes and the outputs. And so the more people are seeing all sorts of folks telling us the news and curating those stories,
yes,
the more it speaks and serves the Australian audiences, which, let's face it, the ABS data says is incredibly diverse, you know, from all walks of life, from all around the world. And that is the tapestry of, you know, our country and what makes it special and beautiful. And so I think the work that we do in the media sector for that reason has huge flow-on impacts, and that means better social cohesion. It means that we're telling stories in a more nuanced way. It means that people like me who grew up thinking, to be perfectly frank, thinking I don't like my identity, and going to school on some days was difficult. Going to school after 9/11 was extraordinarily difficult. In fact, that kind of trauma will stay with me for a long time. Being targeted, I think I may have been in year 11, and people saying to me, Mariam, your country, and they used to call it Afghanistan back then because they didn't know how to pronounce Afghanistan, your country is going to get bombed now for what you did. And like people saying that to me as a young woman and me going, how's that my fault? So I think those things and those people that were making those comments to me were watching all of this unfold on the news. And so the way in which these stories are told can ultimately influence and perpetuate a state of ignorance where people they conflate issues, and or it can provide really nuanced coverage where we discuss the issues without, you know, perhaps, you know, painting it in such a way that implicates an entire global community. Mm. So I think that's why the work we do is so important.
Given you've talked lots about the derogatory remarks, the trolling that you've had to deal with, how do you actually deal with that on a personal level, and more about giving advice for others out there who may experience similar?
Well, look, I've been interviewed for a number of books on the issue of trolling, trying to sort of, and I've written some chapters for books about my experiences. So there's a lot there, but I think the ultimate advice is, you know you're doing something right when you're being targeted,
right.
You know, and in saying that, it is so awful that so many of us from minority communities come to accept it and kind of go, oh, it comes with the territory, and it shouldn't.
No.
It absolutely shouldn't. And for a long time, I just thought, well, this is the price I've got to pay to have an opinion. And, you know, but in I was getting trolled, and I was not a politician. Politicians have access to staff. They have access to, you know, an entire team that can provide support. You know, I was not in high office. I was not in a structure, you know, like I didn't have that scaffolding and support. I mean, there was a period where I would not moderate any of the comments on my social media platforms. And in fact, for a period, my husband was doing it. He's like, you shouldn't be saying what people are saying. Let me be the first person and I'll field your way from some of this. Yeah. I had some friends who were volunteering, you know, like it. So it's, I think you really, it's hard when you're in it, but it's only afterwards that I can go, right, there are periods, my survival mechanism, where there were periods I needed to switch off. I just needed to switch off because I was no use to anyone if I was not mentally okay. And also then I've spoken quite openly about the mental health implications of being trolled for years on, for years, you know, and how chilling that is. Like, to give you an example, there was someone being investigated in by the FBI in the US, and this person was someone who had targeted me, and as it turns out, my name was a number of his passwords. Like it's just chilling, right? Mm-hmm. It just goes, what the, you know, how on earth did I end up in this web? We're talking that the most high profile neo-Nazis of the world, and that in Australia, had targeted me. And so you just kind of go, well, how did I get here? And I think for me, the coping mechanism was surrounding my, you know, maybe doing less anti-work, as in anti-racism, anti-sexism, anti-Islam, and engaging in more positive work. I mean, and that sounds odd, but kind of going, all right, well, how can I still do what I'm doing, but maybe spend more time mentoring people? Yeah. And having real conversations. And those things kind of helped me get through some of the dark times.
Hmm. When you think about cultural diversity and race, what's the difference?
Yeah, look, this is what is the difference between cultural diversity? Without going into sort of dictionary definitions, because this is an evolving space, I'd say even academics that are race scholars, their definitions of what constitutes race is evolving. But I think there is a conflation sometimes of the two. They are absolutely connected. Cultural diversity is seen as a whole host of things, tends to be quite a broad category. So it is your ethnicity. It does speak to, you know, the word CALD, culturally linguistic diversity. Mm. It's what languages do you speak linguistically? What is, you know, linguistic diversity? So it speaks to your ethnicity. It speaks to the language that you speak. It also captures religion, your faith group. It is broadly captured within that. And I think so it captures a whole host of things. But where it becomes, I suppose, complicated is cultural diversity is also how people see themselves. So it could be that you see yourself as an Australian, but you're originally born in South Africa, yeah. You know, like it ultimately that's where it gets tricky. And a lot of retailers, but across other industries, they are starting to capture this as part of their demographic data, you know, within their HR systems, and there is advice that you can obtain to kind of go, well, what's the best way and the most inclusive way to ask this question about cultural diversity, for example, and what does it actually capture, and having drop down boxes that you can select as to what your cultural heritages. But what we're also finding is when it comes to the word race and the word racism by extension, that there is less less of a willingness to use that term, particularly right. in the corporate sphere, yeah. because it starts making us talk about racism.
Yes.
And I'd say up until Black Lives Matter happened, there was a general hesitation across the corporate industry. And I worked in the D&I space with all the major, corporates. There was a general hesitation to use that word because it was too hard. It was put into the too hard basket. You know, Mariam, how do we talk about yeah. Black Lives Matter to our team? I mean, our day jobs are whatever, XYZ industry, but how do we talk about this? And it's complicated. It's not easy. But increasingly what we're seeing is there is more of an appetite to talk about the R word, to talk about racism, and to talk about the fact that we cannot continue to pretend and engage in what is called colorblindness, where people very, with really good intentions, yes. kind of go, I don't see race. I don't see colour. I don't see your gender, Mariam. I'm just going to take you at face value,
yeah.
right? And, of course, the literature goes against that. The literature, and without blowing my own horn, I've done a TED Talk about this, that actually speaks to that literature and speaks to the fact that we almost immediately see race and gender and any point of difference. It unconsciously is the first thing we see. And for me,
because it's so visual, is that what you mean? Because it's such a visual statement.
It's a visual. Yeah. It's a visual statement. If you're going into a job interview, there's some literature that speaks to the fact that that first impression in the first 10 seconds ultimately determines the outcome of the interview. And you're like, how does that make sense? That's ridiculous. But it happens unconsciously. And so what we tend to do is then use the rest of the interview time to kind of confirm to ourselves why we think this person is right. Or if we've got the impression that this person is wrong, we're almost in our own mind going, yes, this is why that person is wrong. And so it's important to understand the psychology of how bias operates. And it also then means the more you understand that psychology and that evidence base, it naturally pushes you to the conclusion that you are not colorblind, that nobody is, that we all have biases. I may have a bias and I may gravitate towards people that have law degrees because yeah. I have this bias in my head going, yeah, everyone who's got a law degree is, super, like that's my bias. I might have a bias towards whatever it is, and so we all have biases. Denying that they exist is part of the problem. And so that's why we're here, because yeah. we constantly shy away from having these tough conversations and the fact that these points of difference can influence decisions. And there's literally another really interesting piece of research, and I'll stop there, and I talk about this in some of my work, is there is multiple studies that have spoken to the fact that, and this might sound funny, but it's the research says that on average, CEOs, male CEOs, tend to be of a certain height.
Oh, really?
So, Paul, I don't recall remembering how tall you are.
I'm like, not that
really
tall,
glad but we're having this conversation. I actually don't remember based on how many. But
that makes sense. That makes sense because they can fill a room, I guess, based on their.
Yes.
Yes.
But then you can't, you can't control your height,
no,
right?
No.
And surely what's it got to do with your level of competence in running an organization?
Yeah.
And yet it literally, the research says that per inch of height, you can actually earn more depending on your height.
You're right.
And so I tease my husband about this all the time because he's quite tall, and I challenge him on his meritocracy. But I think it just goes to show that the evidence base really challenges this idea of a meritocracy.
Yeah, yeah. Now, given that this is retail therapy, how important do you think is the retail sector in setting a positive example for cultural inclusivity for Australia more broadly?
Super important question. And I'd say, and I alluded to this earlier, I'd say it's incredibly important because like I said, in advertising, in shop fronts, in imagery, in websites, in iconic Australian brands and global brands, Australians need to see themselves reflected.
Yes.
And I don't need to convince anybody that there is a positive correlation between representation visually across retail brands and the bottom line. There is literature. In fact, I love to do more research in this space, and it's something Media Diversity will potentially look into. It kind of going, what's the evidence base and the connection yes. point between, you know, consumers feeling represented in those brands? Does that then, you know, what is the financial benefit to retailers of that? And I there is some research, not a whole heap, but I know that there is a positive correlation, and it seems to make, it's pretty obvious, yeah. right? Like it's pretty obvious. If you see yourself reflected, you gravitate towards that brand. You know, if the bank, you know, you've banked with a bank for many, many years, and they start, you start seeing ads, you know, celebrating Chinese New Year, and that speaks to your identity, you are naturally way more inclined to want to stay with that bank. You are naturally inclined to want to continue doing business and taking more of your business there. That's just, you know, one such example. But shop fronts, you know, and I know that I think I'd say retailers are doing a fantastic job. It's come a long way.
It has come
in terms of it's come a huge way, like in terms of just representation. And I think the thing I'd always caution against is that to do it in a way that is sustainable and authentic, that, you know, and I say that because there's times where the intention is in the right place, but because sometimes there isn't that cultural awareness, we may get things wrong. And there are instances where people have come to me going, how great is this ad on the side of this bus? But it's sport, you know, as a Muslim, I can speak to you, you know, there are multiple situations where you would say the words happy Eid, you know, it's like Merry Christmas, right? But, you know, unlike Christmas, which happens once, there's multiple Eid. Yes. And so if the retailer happens to get the wrong Eid because they haven't double checked what that timing is, and it's coming from a good place, but the execution falls short, that's where it becomes, you know, it can be damaging. Like, yeah. And so it's just about, I think the execution there is important to reflect on, but it is amazing to see, to be able to walk in to your local Kmart and see in the imagery that's front of shop, that you see yourself, a part of your heritage reflected in that. I think that's amazing. And I've certainly noticed it from when I was growing up versus to my child, both our kids growing up, and them kind of going, what's the big deal? Where, you know, there was a period where there was not a lot of toys I could buy my daughter that kind of looked like her, yes, like a little bit. Yes. And now there's stacks of them and they don't cost $99. Like, yeah, you know, yeah. like they're affordable. And so I think that speaks to the progress, but also how in many ways it's not just doing it for the sake of, you know, diversity for the sake of diversity. It's authentic. It is Australia. And retailers are just simply reflecting Australia. And I'd say other industries absolutely need to do the same. Otherwise, they'll be left behind.
Mariam, we're out of time, unfortunately. I really enjoyed our time together. Appreciate you joining us for some retail therapy. A pleasure to hear your story and advice, and I'm sure our listeners will greatly appreciate it.
Pleasure. Thanks so much for having me.
I would now like to welcome Mitchell Kourias, Chief Financial Officer at Barbecues Galore, to the Amex Lounge. Barbecues Galore has been supplying Australians with high-quality barbecues and expert advice since 1977. With more than 90 stores throughout the country, Barbecues Galore leads the barbecue retailing market and is a specialist in outdoor furniture and heating. Barbecues Galore has been an American Express merchant for more than two decades. Mitch, welcome.
Hi, Paul. Great to be here with you.
Barbecues Galore is an iconic Australian brand that started as a small business more than 45 years ago. Mitch, can you describe the recent journey of the brand, its challenges, and the transformation over the past 5 years?
The recent journey of Barbecues Galore over the last 5 years has really been to stay true to the heritage of the brand whilst developing our platforms around brand, team and technology to support the changing dynamics of the consumer through this period. And we've seen through the last 5 years some significant macro disruptions from bushfires of 2019 to COVID to supply disruptions. And through that period, the organisation is really galvanised and in really strong position looking forward.
Now, Mitch, it's a tricky time for retailers at the moment as cost of living pressures start to take their toll. How is Barbecues Galore adapting to this and what does the future hold?
A core focus for the organisation is to really focus on demonstrating value through the assortment at every touch point of the assortment. And the team have done a tremendous job through the little while to ensure that we have new, innovative and sometimes exclusive product to really surprise and delight our customers. We also recognise that cost of living pressures are not just on the shoulders of customers but also on our team, and we've done a really put in a lot of work in around ensuring that Barbecues Galore is an employer of choice and supporting our team with those cost of living pressures.
Now, Barbecues Galore purpose is bringing people together around the flame. Those great connections formed around food and fire. Now, how do you go about developing those connections for your customers and your colleagues, and why is this important?
Humans have been sharing treasured moments around a flame for millennia, Paul, and that gives us some really rich material to work with, tooling the team up with their career pathways and help them with that whole sales process helps us to deliver on the purpose to customers as well.
Mitch, thank you for joining us today in the Amex Lounge. All the best for the future.
Thanks, Paul.
Thanks for joining us in the Amex Lounge for some retail therapy. Make sure you subscribe to our show on Apple Podcasts or follow us on Spotify. We can be found wherever you listen to your favourite podcasts. For more information about the work we do at the Australian Retailers Association, head to our website, retail.org.au. Follow us on LinkedIn, Facebook, Twitter, or Instagram, wherever you love to connect. All the links can be found in the show notes.